This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. When something bad happens, people tend to get the same advice. Everything happens for a reason, or time heals all wounds. But my guest today says that advice is useless, and that grief is a chronic condition that you can't just get over. And she should know. In 2014, Nora McInerney had a miscarriage, lost her father, and lost her husband all within the span of 6 weeks. After all of that, Nora became a reluctant grief expert. She's written 3 books. The most recent is called No Happy Endings. She's also the host of the podcast Terrible. Thanks for asking. Nora will be in North Carolina this weekend as part of the first ever Grief Fest. And she joins me now as part of our series of conversations called Embodied, where we talk about sex, relationships, and your health. Nora, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
So for those of our audience who are not familiar with your story, could you tell us a bit more about those 6 weeks that we mentioned where you experienced so much loss?
Well, 2014 was, I think, probably the most memorable year of my life, only because it was the year that pretty much everything bad that has happened to me in those 6 weeks. My husband, Aaron, had stage 4 glioblastoma. It had been about 3 years almost since his diagnosis. He and I had one son together, Ralph, and even though it was clear that Aaron was not going to be a long-term survivor of stage 4 brain cancer, we had decided to try to have another baby through fertility treatments, and it had worked, and I was right at 11 weeks and 6 days. I'd brought Aaron to the hospital for his regular blood draw, and then I had noticed that I was bleeding. And we stopped by my OB's office, and I left him in the car, and I said, I'll be right back. It won't be a big deal. And they did an ultrasound, and they showed me that that little person was not alive anymore. My dad at the time had all kinds of cancer. He had been diagnosed in May, and he was in the ICU on the other side of town. So 5 days after I had that DNC for that miscarriage, I was at my dad's bedside while he died. And 6 weeks after that, Aaron was dead too. So I'm a fun person to talk to. Nobody ever regrets asking me about my life.
Well, as we come up on the 5-year anniversary of Aaron's death, and as you kind of retell that story in a way that you've told it many times, what does it feel like in your body? What does grief feel like in your body at this moment?
Today, it feels really heavy. Today is Aaron's mother's birthday, and I woke up today so grateful that she had brought that person into the world, and honestly just so sad for her version of this loss, which is so different from my own, and so astounded that humans have this ability to carry with them this heavy, jagged pain through their lives. And it's different today than it was 5 years ago. In some ways, I think it's more developed. I have more of a sense of how I feel in my body, or how I feel even emotionally, in a way that I didn't at first, because shock is a real thing. But today I feel very, very heavy and slow and tired, and I just want to take a nap. And that's what this time of year does to me, honestly. I live in Minnesota. It's cold here already. It's dark here already. I just feel like hibernating until this season is over. I think that honestly, and if you listen to my podcast or you read my books, they're very funny too. And not, I wouldn't say intentionally, I'm not trying to make fun of any of these feelings or make light of any of these situations, but they do have a natural levity to them. And anybody who has suffered, I think, can sort of relate to that. But
well, that's strikes me about your podcast is that I feel like it really gives people the space to tell their story of grief in such a full and whole way, acknowledging the gross things, acknowledging the weird things, acknowledging the funny things, while also holding space for the deep sadness. And I'm wondering for you, how did you come to this point of being able to kind of accept that those can coexist, that you can simultaneously be deeply grieving and also falling in love and also, you know, having an active sex life and all the other things about life that just continue?
I think I learned them from watching Erin, because, I mean, another feeling that I want to validate for people is that grief doesn't necessarily start when somebody dies. And Erin was 31 or 32 when he was diagnosed, and he was so alive for those 3 years when his body was dying. He was so funny. Some of our best memories as a family happened when we were in the hospital, which is so strange, but he made everything feel like it was a party. We would have Valentine's Day, you know, on the oncology floor, and I would bring LED candles, and he cracked me up all the time. Erin got best dressed in his radiation oncology department. They don't typically give out awards, but he got best dressed, okay, because he had style, and he lived as the embodiment of, you know, both and, where he showed me that it's possible to live a life where you're struggling and also you are experiencing joy. I did not think that I had the right to that without him, though. And I did not know how to live in a world where if people see you doing normal people stuff, like buying groceries and wearing makeup and showing up at work and posting on the internet, then they think it's over and you're probably fine. And maybe they're relieved, or maybe they're judgmental that you aren't more visibly wrung out for them, that you have not performed your grief to their, you know, unspoken specifications. And I felt the burden of those unsaid expectations or norms after Erin died.
As you have built a new relationship and you have a blended family now with your husband Matthew and his kids and a kid that you've had together, how do you incorporate remembering Erin into the daily life of your family?
It happens really naturally, and part of that is because of the nature of our family. I think that being a widowed mother made me more prepared to be, you know, an additional parent in these children's lives and to approach these newer children, these older kids who are now a part of my family and who are my kids, who I love with every bit of my heart the same way I love the ones who came out of me. I think that gave me the capacity to approach these kids and know that they've been through something too, and that the same way I don't want my current happiness to come at the cost of, you know, me having to deny my past, I don't want my current happiness to make it seem as if I am never, ever, you know, sad. I want these kids to know that it is all mixed up together, that of course we have this beautiful family and yeah, it rules, we're the best. And also we got here because two other things broke apart, and that's okay. It is okay to be sad on Christmas because being with us means you're not with someone else. It's okay to be happy for what you have and miss what you had. That's okay. So the same way that, you know, I talk about Erin, and we have pictures of, you know, Erin and myself and Ralph up in our home. We have pictures of the kids when they were little before I knew them in our home. Erin's mom takes all the kids out for their birthday. She brings Christmas presents for all of them. We all go and visit Erin's family after Christmas, the same way that Matthew's family and my mother have absorbed all of these children. And Thanksgiving will include bits and pieces from all three branches of this family. So for me, it's not just how can I keep, you know, Erin present in our lives. It's how can I make sure that these kids know that who they are now does not cost who they were.
How do your kids think about death? And how do you all have conversations about kind of death in the abstract after all you've gone through?
the interesting thing is to have children who span such a range means that we have a child who will be 3 very soon, and we live on the edge of a nature reserve. And somebody unfortunately ran over a rabbit outside of our house. It's a baby rabbit, and our child was fascinated by that, really fascinated. And so is Ralph. Ralph understands what it means to die, but a 3-year-old does not. And he wanted to know if he could go get this bunny a new eyeball. He wanted to know what he could do to make this bunny feel better. And we tried to explain what death is, and he said he understood it, and he put some flowers on this bunny. But he still talks about that bunny every day, and because the bunny is gone, he wants to know if it's better. And Ralph is like, you know, Ralph, whose dad died when he was, you know, not even 2 years old, he is very, very comfortable talking about death and always has been. When he was 3 years old, he would look at a person at the park and say, "Oh, my dad's dead." And the person would look at me like, "What is wrong with this child?" And I was like, "Oh, no, his dad's dead. That's what he just wants you to know. He just, you know, what's new with you? He just wants you to know that his dad's dead. How is your dad?" The older kids have experienced a lot of different kinds of loss. We had another death in our family 2 years ago. And I'm not necessarily a religious person, but I do believe that the people that we love remain with us, and they remain with us in our memory. And they also, I just feel their energy. I do. I feel Aaron around me. I feel my dad around me. And I think children are kind of naturally open to that. And we talk about that with their uncle who died too. Like we just talk about people who have died. I don't want them to think that, you know, that you shouldn't bring something up because it might make somebody sad. I want them to know that if you're thinking about someone, say it. Say it. And it doesn't have to just be the person's death. You could be thinking about your uncle's life. You could be curious about your uncle's life. And you can ask about that.
So your podcast, Terrible Thanks for Asking, you invite people on, and they're often sharing stories about some of the very worst moments of their lives. And your podcast, I have laughed when listening to it. I have cried, and it can be really, really hard to listen to. And even saying that kind of makes me feel guilty that, like, I can't bear witness to someone's most horrible moment that I didn't even experience. What do you make of that reaction and kind of various people's response to your podcast who maybe haven't experienced some of the things that you're sharing as intimately?
So there's two responses to people finding out about my podcast. And one is, "Oh, what's that? I'm going to download that." And the other is, who would listen to that? Why would I ever want to listen to that? And I don't blame you for having either reaction. I don't think necessarily that I would have had the appetite for it before I had experienced loss. Mm. But I do know that a significant number of people listen to it almost in anticipation of their own loss and their own suffering. And I do think that, you know, you are not obligated to bear witness to the suffering of all the world. There's plenty of it. My grandpa told me every day, like, "Oh, you know, the world is a sad story." But I do think that people can find a capacity for empathy in these situations. And a lot of our subjects, the story is complicated. The story is complicated by the characters in it, by the person who is owning and narrating their version of the story, by the bigger, you know, systemic circumstances that surround the story. And I'm not interested in making a show that just is, you know, a sort of tragedy porn that people can use to just shower other people with pity. I want people to take the time to consider these situations and to consider the place that people find themselves in life and also emotionally, because we do live in a world that exposes us to so much humanity and also cuts us off from so much humanity. We've never had more opportunities to connect with one another. And it's also, I don't know if it's ever been easier to be so casually cruel and dismissive of people than it is now.
Have you discovered any limits to your own ability to empathize? Do you get empathy fatigue having your own experience and doing this work?
I mean, I have limits. I'm tragically a human person, and they have not found a cure for that yet. I have had interviews that were extremely challenging for me. Extremely challenging for me, and I've tried to be honest about that in the interviews. And also, those have provided some opportunity for reflection on why it is harder for me to empathize with some people in some situations than it is for others. I do this work, but I also spend a pretty decent amount of time, you know, alone and with my family and kind of not isolated, but like sort of insulated. Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of time working on myself because God, I need it. Like, I really do. I really do. I'm reading Pema Chodron. Okay. I am reading, you know, child psychology books. I am trying my best, to be as mentally healthy as possible because it's hard. It is hard. This is a job that I'm so lucky to have. And also some days, like today, when I really just want to sit down and cry because it's so terrible to me that some people outlive their children. And Aaron was 35 and he would say, "This isn't sad, Nora. It's sad when a little kid dies." Well, little kids do die. And sometimes just all of the pain of the world does feel like it's seeping into me. And I need to stand in the shower and cry out loud for 10 minutes. And so that might be on the agenda after this call.
Is there anything else that you do in those moments or any kind of advice you'd have to people who are really in the thick of that kind of grief today hearing this?
Honestly, if you are in the thick of grief, feel it. Feel it. My friend is an actual psychologist, and she has said the average feeling of grief is 90 seconds. It feels like 100 years. But those huge, huge, overwhelming waves of emotion are about 90 seconds long. And to be able to just feel what you feel without apologizing or without feeling like you should be feeling something else is huge. And we rush through that. And I rushed through that. And there is no way around it. You do have to go through it. The response that we have to people who are suffering and the response people are having to you, if you are deep in grief, when people are like, "Oh, you know what? Everything happens for a reason," or, "Oh, just do this," people who are trying to fix it, that's not an empathetic response. It's a pity response. Because empathy understands that you can't fix everything and that the only way around is through. You got to go through it. And it is a sacred time. And it is a privilege to be a person who can grieve. I know that not everybody can. My best friend was back at work 2 days after her husband died because if you don't work, you don't get paid. So I do understand that it is, it's a privilege to be able to even say, like, feel your feelings. But if you're finding yourself editing them for the audience around you, I just want you to consider whether you're telling people you're fine because you really are, or if you're telling people you're fine because you just don't want to burden them. Because the people who really want to show up for you and just don't know how, they do have to know the truth. And if the truth is everything sucks right now and I don't know what I need, then that's what you say.
Nora McInerney is the author of No Happy Endings, a memoir, and two other books. She's also the host of the podcast Terrible. Thanks for asking. Nora, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nora will be at the first ever Grief Fest at the Pullen Memorial Baptist Church in Raleigh on Sunday, October 27th. You can find details about how to attend at our website, stateofthings.org. While you're there, you can also find links to the rest of our Embodied series. Just ahead, the music of Lisa R. and the Lucky Stars. Please stay with us.
No, I won't be going back without you.